Welcome to the Vantage Point podcast, Sam. Thanks so much for joining me today. First of all, how are you?
Glenn, what's the crack? Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, feeling really good. We're about 3 weeks out now from the play. We're in the weeds of all the marketing, PR push. I don't want to know how many people have either muted me or unfollowed me. We're in the end game now before we open on the 20th. So it's just about 3 weeks to go now. So really excited, really looking forward to it. I just can't wait to get back on stage. Yeah.
It might be like the week before when this comes out, so that'd be pretty good timing in that case. Before we do a deep dive on the Manny tour, I want to find out a bit about you first. Where did you start? What first got you into the world of theatre and acting?
I think I was 18 years old and I went to uni, and I'd always been interested in being on stage, but probably in a different way. I used to be a guitarist and a singer in a band. Just weren't good enough, really. I really did enjoy being on stage, writing songs, being creative. And I was a rugby jock in school, and I busted my shoulder and I was feeling sorry for myself, and I just started reading Shakespeare to relax me. And I just love storytelling. I've always been interested in stories since I was a kid. Movies, comic books, that kind of relaxed me. And then I joined the Amdram Society in uni and went to a place called Trinity College, and they have an Amdram group called Players. I just loved it. I found people in a group who were as weird as me. We did plays for the next 4 years, and I heard about this mythical far-off land called Drama School in London. And I spent a summer in my first year. All my mates went off traveling, and I was able to get into a drama school called RADA. Did a summer course for 8 weeks where you learn how to be an actor, and you learn about your voice and your body, and you learn how to approach text and script analysis. And I loved it. And I spent every single second the next 3 years saving up cash to go to drama school. And then, yeah, came over here in 2010, went to a great drama school called Guildhall. I left, got a great agent, got to go on tour around the world twice, some movies and TV. I ended up eventually coming back to Dublin, really. Yeah, I fell out of love with acting. I probably was very hard on myself in my 20s. And I think I put a real weight on my shoulders. Like, I wanted to be huge by the time I was 28. And I wanted to buy my parents their retirement home. Who's buying homes at 28 for themselves, let alone their parents? I just kind of got worn down with it. And I stepped away from acting completely. And it was only really during lockdown, I got a 9-to-5 job. I was working in a consultancy company. And then when lockdown hit, I just decided to start writing about this weird job I used to have where I was a male nanny working for rich mums in single London. I managed to find, just by chance, like a lucky, lovely place down the road from my family so I could check in on my parents. I had a really nice, secure 9-to-5 job. My friends were around me. I had a good life, but it didn't really feel like my life. I kept having dreams like once a week about you got to go back to London and you got to put the show on. And I felt like in some ways I kind of wasn't being authentically myself. I decided to quit my 9-to-5 job, come back here in the summer of 2021. I started to get in touch with some old friends. So a friend of mine, Mel Fulbrook, who as well as being in drama school with me, is also a successful director. I said, Mel, I got this idea for a show. Are you in? No one had said yes to me. I had applied to a couple of theaters in Dublin, a couple of the fringe festivals, and they said, nah, the Manny thing, no, it needs a lot more work. But I felt like it was ready. I wanted to come back to London. And Mel was the only one who said, yeah, okay, let's go for it. We just scratch reading. So scratch reading is when it's like a work in progress thing where you invite a couple of people and you have the script in your hand sometimes and you read it out. But I hadn't acted in over 4 years and I'd lost all my self-confidence. And I didn't know if I could do it or not. So I decided to put that pressure on myself. Stupidly, I'm going to learn the whole script. I'm going to invite loads of people. Let's just see if I still have it or not. And I was really fortunate that the play sold out both nights and I got really good feedback. And we ended up bringing the show to King's Head Theatre in January this year, January 2023. We got great feedback again. But I also really wanted to bring the show back to Dublin. I'd never acted in Dublin before. And I'd gone back for 4 years, and the first two of those years, I was a fucking failure. I was unemployed, living in my parents' spare room, and I wanted to prove to myself that I could still make it. So we ended up going back to a theatre called Smock Alley. It went really well there. We sold out the run. And I kind of felt like, I know it's a bit naff to say, I always think of like healing the ground. So I always think of, you got that friend who gets dumped, and they're like, Glenn, we can't go to that restaurant anymore. That's where me and Michelle used to go. And I used to have that feeling about Dublin when I was back there. I used to be like, oh, I feel like a bit of a knob being back here. This is where I remember walking down this road. This is where I was stressed. And I wanted to go back to Dublin to heal that ground. So it was really cool to do that at the end of last year. And now we're going to play our biggest headline show for 2 nights at the Pleasance Theatre this coming March. And I'm really excited for it. Yeah, so we're bringing the show back on the road. And then we're going to go back to Dublin for 3 more theatres. So yeah, we're keeping going.
So the show's actually inspired by your real life job, if I'm getting this right, as a male nanny. What was it like working as that? How did you even end
Weird.
up there? Yeah, I
Yeah,
bet.
so when I came out of drama school, and my flatmate at the time, an actor called Rhys Rusbach, which is still the greatest name I've ever heard, he said, "Mate," I'm not going to do the Welsh accent. He said, "Mate, there's an agency and it caters for actors. It's flexible, well-paid work." And I was like, "Mate, you had me at well-paid. I'm in." And you essentially are basically you put your headshot on the website, and the mums choose which one they want, and you do everything from like looking after the kids, picking up from school, cooking them food. It was a mad job. And I did that for a couple of years and I loved it. It was brilliant. Yeah, it was flexible, it was well paid. It was something different. And I met so many characters, so many lovely kids, so many walking Durex ads, so many weird parents. So it really made me think differently about life as well. I was only 25, but it didn't make me think about God. I don't know if I want kids. And it was very interesting. The first family I had were American. And I was going off a lot of American auditions at the time. So I would practice my American. I was speaking an American accent the whole time with them. So they would be like, "Oh, your R's are weird." Like it was a 10 and 12-year-old boy and girl. And then I would start kind of teaching them, I guess, how to cook, the young boy, like how to shave. And it came at a really interesting time in my life because it was actually 2013. And that's really when like dating apps started to really come on the scene. And I remember I got on really well with the mums. I don't. It's funny whenever I say, "Oh yeah, I was a male nanny." Everyone's like, "Oh, did you hook up with the mums?" No, of course not. That would be grossly inappropriate and weird. They wasn't always single parents. Sometimes there'd be they the dads would be there too. But it really made me think differently about how I am as a bloke because the mums would be saying, "Oh, John is really listening to you. You know, he talks like you now." So Irish people say "like" a lot. But he started saying "your man" or "great crack," and that kind of made me go, "I wonder if I'm subconsciously saying stuff. You know, I should check myself, make sure I'm not saying anything bad or derogatory in any way. Not that I'm going around drinking cans of Stella, cursing at people whilst bringing the kids home from school, but you know, people look up to their elder siblings or whatever. So you want to make sure you're setting a good example. And I loved it. It's a job you can do in your 20s. I did feel after a while, I can't keep doing this job, it's a bit mental. But I do remember the inspiration for the show, it kind of came in two parts. One was, so we were working at like a school summer fair one day, just off Sloane Square. We're talking 25 degrees, and this posh school, so much cash, we're just throwing it around. They hired all these mannies just to help with setting the place up, doing referee for the kids' games, all that. And I was chatting to one of the mannies, and he was like, "Nice guy, weak handshake, small little lad." And he was saying to the moms, "Yeah, I just love being a positive influence in their lives. And I really think like me working with them is making me a better person." And the moms would be like, "Oh my God, John, you're so sweet." And he would look at me and I kind of wink like, "Got him." And I thought, isn't that mental? I never thought like to use that to make yourself feel like a good guy is like outrageous. And that night I went to meet a girl for a drink and she said, "What you do today?" And I said, "Oh, I'm a Manny. I look after people's kids." She's like, "Oh my God, that's so cute and sweet." And I was really, really quick to go, "No, I don't want you to think I'm using that as a line. I don't want you to think I'm using that as a way to appear like a nice guy." But I thought that'd be such an interesting character, a guy who uses that job just to like to woo girls, I guess. And the second inspiration of it was, I guess I'd always had a certain amount, just to bring it back down in a heavy way. I'd always realized in my late 20s, I probably had a bit more anxiety than I realized. And when I hit 30, you know, I think when you're an actor, there's a huge, you put a huge pressure on yourself to make it. You know, there's people literally walking around now looking at those Dune 2 posters going, "That should have been me," even though they were never near the casting. I was probably no different in some ways. I came close to some cool big stuff, but didn't make it. And I think when I went back to Dublin, I just felt around me a lot of people had more anxiety than they were letting on. A lot of people had the sense of disappointment that they hadn't made it, whatever it is to different people, what it is to people working in finance could be different to people who are working as mechanics, to people who are working as, whatever. I was really interested in those themes, so I kind of wanted to write a show about that. It started off just a form of therapy, me writing the show. I didn't really even know what I was writing first. I was just kind of writing anecdotes about me as a Manny. The more the script developed, the more I wanted to like harness those ideas about exploring those themes. But I also wanted to make it light in a way. I didn't want to be like, first scene, depression. I wanted to just basically explore those themes through the prism of a male nanny working for rich single mums, because that's an outrageous image.
In the show, you play all three characters, right? You play Manny, Molly, and Michael. How do you bring these characters to life then? Molly or Michael, are they based on real people that you've met?
The Michael character is based on a young boy I used to look after who loved World War II. The Molly character, that character's kind of more up for interpretation, I think.
I've heard you before talking about embracing certain aspects of masculinity, maybe in a way that aren't already out there for the kids that were looking up to you when you were Manny for them. And maybe even now with your current audience, what does being a good role model mean for you?
Do you mean like role model, like in terms of to like your younger siblings or like to your mates or?
Just in terms of the broader message you want to put out with regards to masculinity, there's a lot of negative connotations with that. I've seen you talk about it before. The young kids would look up to you as, oh, this is maybe what I should be like. And so it would put pressure on you to come across in a certain way so that you knew you were setting a good example for them. What is that way that you want to come across?
A therapist would have a minefield with this. I always kind of imagine myself as like if I was a movie and I was playing the main character, how would you want the audience rooting for you? Would the audience be rooting for you if you act in a certain way? Just try not to be a dickhead, really. It's a really hard question that you've asked me, and I mean that honestly, not flippantly, because I think masculinity is changing so much in today's world. And I think men, we do have a lot to answer for and a lot to make up for. We've been led away with a lot over the years, and there's a lot more, I don't want to say reprogramming, I guess re-educating. Take my background, for example. I went to a very religious school. It was boys, all boys. So we would only meet girls on nights out or after school. So there was already this us and them narrative embedded into us. And it was only when we got to uni that we were with each other in normal day. And I think that there's a certain amount of us and them that really needs to be addressed, I think. But then also it's hard because I think, men can sometimes, we have to be strong, but we also have to be soft. We have to show vulnerability, but we must be not flippant. We must always be steady. The things you shouldn't have ever been able to do, it's good that you're getting called out for. I can only speak as a man, how we experience life. It's tricky. I mean, like, if we're going to go there, like men first learn about intimacy through porn because we watch it. I don't even want to know what it's like if you're an 11-year-old now and you have access to a smartphone, probably younger. Completely plays havoc with your head, for starters. I don't know if I've in any way answered your question there. Sorry.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's an interesting insight, man. Does it help in any way having played the role of a woman in your show to sort of get in the head of what women think?
I don't think so. I mean, every girlfriend I've had has at least one story of a very unpleasant slash distressing experience with men, and that really kind of alarmed me. It did make me think different about masculinity as a whole. A person has a certain amount of masculine, feminine energy inside them, and it's up to them to how they listen to it and how that energy is expressed, I think. I'm going to sound like a bit of a knob here for a sec. I don't mean to. And I think in those years when I was pretty rock bottom for about 16 months when I was unemployed. I spent a lot of time on my own, either working out or cooking. They're my two things, or being on social welfare. And it did make me think differently about me as a bloke. I read a lot of books, had a lot of thinking to do. Not that my conscience wasn't clean, it was. But yeah, you always look back, and the more you go inwards, you think about how you are and how you've come across. Like my last couple of exes, parents came to see the show. My ex who was in Dublin, her mum came, which was lovely. She couldn't come because she was away traveling. And my ex-girlfriend before that, her mum came. In London, when I did the show in January, there were women I'd been on a date with from Tinder like 10 years ago that were there. So it was really interesting. It was lovely. Like I really felt like a supportive energy there. And I think the character can be quite triggering in a way. He doesn't do anything like physically bad. Like he's not that kind of a bad guy, traumatic guy. He's just basically, I guess, a bit of a player, but there's a different side to him as well, which hopefully is seen in the play. How he is as a person is explained. I think people can relate to that, not just women. Try and put a bow in your question. It made me think differently just about how people are in relationships, And I think men, we're as bad as each other. Dating, it's like the Vietnam War. Neither side wants to be there. Neither side wants to pull out first. And we're as bad as each each other. I did have to. I was out for drinks on Friday with a group of people, and someone was like, "Oh, you know, I hate the apps because there's a lot of fuck boys on the apps," which is true. I'm sure there is. You know, we're as bad as each other. I'm not on the apps anymore, but especially in London, there's a real sense of just transactional, getting ghosted. When you're on the apps, you're always kind of looking for like who's the next person to get. And the play is also commentary on just the vacuousness of these apps. The photos you put up are never indicative of who you are as a person. You only find out what the person is like 6 months in, probably only a year. So what the fuck are we doing going around with these apps going, yeah, you look like your photos. Oh my God, we like the same music. You like Glass Animals and Kanye? You're so authentic. Like, please. And it's a shame when you hear about your grandparents' times and how they met. Well, I saw your grandmother at a dance and I cycled over three fields with a crappy bicycle to put a letter in to ask her out. Whereas now you're at these weddings and it's like, we met on the apps and oh my God, we both liked Ed Sheeran. And I'm like, kill me, fucking kill me. So yeah.
It might feel a bit hopeless for the young generation at the moment who are almost reliant on dating apps to meet a girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever. In your experience, what are some things that people could be doing to maybe find a more long-term relationship, something with legs on it, as opposed to just something that's transactional?
A friend of mine did say something really interesting to me, and she said how when you focus on yourself and doing things you enjoy, improving or leveling up, you do attract people. And I'm a big believer in that you attract what you tolerate. So if you're someone who tolerates a certain character level, that's all you will attract. No matter how much you're in the gym, no matter how good your clothes are, if you're settling for a certain level of character. I've got goals and objectives that I want to get done, but I also try and think of words as well. Like last year was in essence selfishness. And what that meant was I just want to do stuff that I want to do. So if that's all day in bed playing guitar, all day eating M&Ms, or allowing myself a treat. So for example, I got into yoga last year. I go to a yoga studio called Waking Dreams. And I go like six, seven times a week now. I'm there every day. There's different classes. I'm going to sound like such a dickhead saying this. I'm not going there to pull. I don't have a flirty energy when I'm in there. I'm just there because it's a really safe space. I want to get better at all the stands. I love the restorative classes we do on the weekend. I think because I'm being myself, well, I'm probably friend zoning anyone anyway. But I think when you're essentially being yourself, you're being calm, you're being in your own body. You'll attract the people that you're meant to attract. I refuse to say the word your tribe. I will not say that, but you attract the people that are operating on the same level as you. How to get along and how to keep a long-term relationship? I think it comes down to communication. That's the main thing. But I always think of my head as a garden, and you got to weed that garden. You can't let things fester and you can't let things grow. So if I had a problem with someone, I'd like to think, say it openly, calmly, directly to them. Hey, just so you know, when you do X, it's going to make me feel like Y. Yeah, communication is a huge thing. And your own interests. You don't want someone living out your pocket as well. Just someone who you can trust as well. Yeah, that's what I would say, which is so hard to come by because they don't really go hand in hand. So.
Yeah, speaking of aspirations and being selfish for a minute, what are your aspirations beyond the Manny tour? Do you see yourself doing more movies? I know you initially wrote it as a TV pilot, I believe. Is it more theatre, more TV shows? What do you want to do going forward?
I originally wrote the show just as a one-person show, but then as I was writing it, I thought I'd love to kind of turn this into a TV show. So I've written a TV pilot too. My aspirations are to get signed by an agent, turn this into a TV show, build on the success of The Pleasance and King's Head and Smock Alley to bring the show to a bigger theatre in London. Sell well. We're bringing the show to the Civic Theatre, Viking, and The Whale back in Ireland. Just get the money out there and bring it to different theatres. I'd love to bring the show abroad. What I'm doing now has kind of made me the happiest I've ever been. I'm a huge WWE fan. I'm a huge wrestling fan. And my favorite ever wrestler is this guy called Edge, Adam Copeland. And he basically had like a triple neck fusion surgery, couldn't wrestle for years. And then he came back to wrestle. I can't believe I'm going on this tangent. He came back to wrestle in, he came back as a surprise like contestant in this thing called the Royal Rumble in, must have been, I think it was January 2020. And I'd started to write the show then. And that's a real, he's actually a real inspiration to me because I was like, if he can get over neck fusion surgery, I can get over feeling a bit down. And he talks about climbing the second mountain. I think he stole it from a book. I'm stealing it from him, so it's all good. But I feel like now I'm on my second mountain and I feel like I'm the happiest I've ever been. And I feel like the trauma that I probably put myself through, but the stress I put myself through in the 20s has resulted in me being the happiest and most authentic version of myself. in a weird way, I feel like I've already won. And there's a part of me that thinks maybe this is just what's going to happen, the Pleasance. Then we do the Dublin tour, and that's it. But I would love to keep it going. Yeah. So I'm just trying to do things that I think in my 20s, I'm trying to do what I wish I did in my 20s, be a bit more, have a bit more moxie. So, for example, we're getting the flyers done very soon, and I'm just going to go up to theaters, stand outside, and as the people come out after their amazing, lovely, cultured night, I'll just walk up to all of them with a big smile on my face and say, "Irish male nanny working for rich single mums. Irish male nanny working for rich single mums." That's what I did for King's Head before, and it worked, and we sold out there. So, yeah, that's the aspirations. Just keep working on the show, redefining it, hopefully bring it to different theaters. Make some money. Is that really bad to say? I don't know. I just want to make some money. I was really broke in my 20s. I don't want to be broke anymore.
When you see the decline in ratings at the Oscars, the increasingly regular box office bombs in Hollywood, the recent strikes, the danger of AI replacing background characters, writers, and editors, do you have a fear for the future of your industry?
Can't control that, so I try not to stress about it. I just freak out about what I can control. Yeah, of course, like AI is literally coming to take our jobs. It's a huge threat, and we've managed to stop it for now. People will always watch the Oscars. People will always go to the cinema. It's a source of relief, enjoyment for people. But AI is a huge threat. Yeah, that's definitely something coming.
I suppose one thing that you can do to combat AI and continue to combat AI is just keep coming up with original ideas. Like, what you're doing with the Manny. I've not heard of anything like that in a while, or anything like that, probably ever actually. And if people keep coming up with new stuff, AI can only reference itself. So you'll always be ahead of the curve if you can get your own stuff out there. Tell me about some of the troubles you've had in putting your own production together and getting a show out there.
I've had more no's and more rejection than a 16-year-old acne-ridden Sam at the disco. I mean, we've had funders literally drop out at the last minute, theaters change their minds, the whole thing. I've had agents put me up for stuff and then we're really interested in you. And then they ring me up and they go, "Do you know what? I think you're really good looking, but I don't think you can act. I don't think you're charismatic. I don't think you're unique. And I don't think there's anything I can do with you." I'm like, "Okay, cool." Like the rejection is just, you just have to almost wipe it off and just keep going. So there's the Arts Council in the UK give away money. You have to write an Arts Council application. They're about a 50-page document you have to put together. It's kind of like getting an enema with a wooden spoon off your ex's new partner, and the whole operation is funded by your ex's family. It's just absolute agony. And I've done it twice and I've been rejected both times. So we're going around now for a third time because I love self-inflicting pain. And hopefully, if we get the funding for that, we can put the show on in a bigger venue. There's been so many hurdles. So you just got to keep going. And the things that have kept me sane are yoga. So the yoga studio I go to, go and give a little plug out to them. It's called Waking Dreams, just off Broadway Market. And I go there every day and I meditate in the mornings. And I actually take, it's funny, I'm not really much of a, not that I was there, I probably did booze quite a lot in my 20s. So I just drink Lucky Saints now on nights out. The fact I've got a can of alcohol beside me on a Zoom call probably isn't a good indicator, but it's from a night out. I just haven't put it away. But I think when you kind of just, when you, what stops me from getting stressed out about the rejection is just being cognizant of the fact that you're going to get so many no's, and that's okay. Are you right to be offended, or are you just being a bit sensitive? So when I get all these knockbacks, you got to choose very quickly which ones you're going to get angry about, because energy, like time, is a finite source and you got to keep going. I'm very strict and I'm very tight with the people I hang out with, and I just stay away from energy vampires.
We're almost out of time, but I just wanted to finish on this. Before we go, tell our listeners when and where and why they should experience the Manny for themselves.
The Manny is going to be on the Pleasance Theatre March 20th and 23rd, Wednesday and Saturday at 7:30. It's a story about basically unrequited dreams, anxiety, sense of loneliness in your 30s, and the vacuousness of dating apps. And I think there's something in the themes that any gender can relate to. It's only 70 minutes long, so you won't be there for too long if you don't enjoy it.
I'll have a link to everything down below underneath the episode. Yeah, we've got to end it there. Sam, thanks so much for your time.
Glenn, thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it. Had a great time.